your sleep. Rise to a new day with each your soul to keep.
Hello, and welcome to the Enlightened Medicine Show with Dr. Valerie Olmsted, the holographic physician. And with my special guest tonight, Dr. Marco Iacoboni, who has written a book called Mirroring People, The New Science of How We Connect with Others. This is going to be fun. So welcome to the show, Dr. Iacoboni.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be so much fun. I'm hoping that the listeners will call in and ask you a couple questions, but if they don't, I'm going to hog you all to myself.
So, all right.
It'll be a lot of fun. I find your book fascinating. So let me just give the listeners a little heads up on who you are. Dr. Iacoboni is a professor of psychiatry and biobehavioral sciences and the director of the Transcranial Magnetic Stimulation Lab at the Amundsen Lovelace Brain Mapping Center of the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. Boy, that's a mouthful. And he has pioneered the research on mirror neurons, the smart cells in our brain that allow us to understand others. His research has been covered by the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, Time, The Economist, and major TV networks. So we're going to talk about his new book tonight. As I read this book, Dr. Iacoboni, I just kept saying, wow, wow, wow. It just explains so much. So I am going to shut up, and I'm going to let you give your bio to the people first and tell them who you are and how you got into all this, and then just launch on into explaining the mirror neurons, if you would.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's certainly an exciting time because this discovery, which was made about less than 20 years ago, these cells were originally discovered in the monkey brain. It seems really to explain a lot of human behavior, and in fact, in a way, it could even be seen almost as the limitation of these cells, because what these cells do, at least what they can potentially explain, is so much that some people start saying, well, wait a minute, they can't explain all those things. It's almost like unfair for, you know, the rest of the brain, that they can have such a powerful explanatory potential. But in fact, I mean, what they do is really seems to be so important for human interaction that, you know, after all, our life, it's about interaction. It's about relations with other people. We don't live as islands. We belong to our social networks, and all our life is meaningful because of our connections, our relations. And they really seem to be very important for human relations. So what are these cells? Well, they're called mirror neurons because they were discovered in the monkey brain by neurophysiologists that were looking at how the brain controls our own actions. And of course, the idea is that you look into the monkey because the monkey is a precursor of, is an animal that preceded us in evolutionary terms. And of course, we can't look into, unless you have really some rare clinical opportunities, and we can talk about that. But generally, when you look at individual cells, you can't really look into the human brain because it's too invasive to implant electrodes in the human brain. And so the way we tend to understand the human brain is by looking at the animals that preceded us in evolutionary terms. And of course, you know, monkeys are a good model for that because they're relatively close to us. And so these physiologists were looking at how some parts of the brain control our actions. And of course, what you find in the areas of the brain that we call the motor cortex, the one that the part of the brain that controls our action, what you find is that there are neurons that fire for actions. And so when the monkey was grasping certain things, the neurons would fire. That makes a lot of sense. But the discovery of mirror neurons is that some of these cells in the motor cortex that fire when the monkey makes an action also fire when the monkey is completely still. And it's just observing somebody else making exactly the same action. So they found that, for instance, there were neurons for grasping that would fire when a monkey would grasp. And they would also fire when the monkey would see somebody else grasping. The monkey is still, he's in the primate chair, just watching, you know, the human experimenters doing their own things. And when the human scientist is, you know, in front of the monkey and he's grasping something, the same cell that fires when the monkey grasps also fire when the monkey is seeing somebody else grasping. It is, and that's why they're called mirror neurons, because it seems almost that the monkey is observing their own action reflected by a mirror by watching other people making those actions.
Mm-hmm. And so monkey see, monkey do.
Exactly. I mean, one way, initially they were called also monkey see, monkey do cells, but then the term mirror became more popular, and this, you know, we're all fascinated by mirrors. And so, and in fact, I mean, the idea is that, in a way, what these cells do is almost kind of simulating in our own brain what other people are doing. So if part of my brain lights up or fire up when I grasp something, let's say a cup of coffee, and I'm looking at you, and the same cells that fire up when I grasp a cup of coffee and control my muscles when I actually put my fingers around a cup of coffee and I grab it and then I put it in the mouth, if those cells also fire when I see you doing the same thing, the same, exactly the same action, grasping a cup of coffee, I have an immediate understanding of what's going on in your brain, what you intend to do, what's the action you're doing. I don't have to make any, you know, complex inference about your intentions and your own action. It's almost as if you are in my own head when I see you doing things. So they really create a strong connection between people.
This is something that really, well, I have a lot of questions about that, but one of the things that impressed me was, of course, the correlation to TV and violence and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And we'll talk about that a little bit later if you want. But but I just was so amazed, because we have, on this show, we talk about, you know, how we are basically one, all of us. And we talk about the spiritual issues that affect our health. And we talk about, you know, how we can have empathy and how we can feel what someone else is doing. And for instance, how do we know when somebody has evil intentions? And your work explains it.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's one of the fascinating things about this work, is that, in fact, it explains something that we take for granted because we're really good at doing it. And when we are good at doing things, we can't take those things for granted. But, in fact, it's almost a miracle that we understand the minds of others so well. After all, when I relate to other people, I interact with them, and I look at what they do and how they express their own emotion, I have only access to my own mind. I can't really get into their own mind. So, but on the other hand, we're really good at understanding what other people intend to do, what they feel, and so on. Unless we're really in complicated situations, but in real life and everyday life interaction, we're really good at getting what people do. And again, we take this for granted. It's almost a miracle. It is not a miracle. It's something that evolution designed us to be good at by using these cells, because again, what these cells allow us to do is to kind of simulate in our own brain what other people are doing just by watching them. So they create really a strong connection between people. You mentioned empathy, and when it comes to emotion, of course, when we made this discovery, and one thing that we wanted to find out is that, you know, how important are these cells for human behavior? I mean, the cells, again, were discovered in the monkey brain, but, of course, we translated this work into the human brain using brain imaging techniques. So the first thing we wanted to find out was how important are these cells and this system, which we call the mirror neuron system in the human brain, for imitation. They seem to be really designed for imitation because, of course, they fire when you make an action, when you see somebody else making an action. It turns out that imitation is a fundamental way in which we learn how to do things. We can bypass very time-consuming, learning process by trial and error just by watching other people that do things and they're skilled at doing things. But it also seems that imitation is a strong, there is a psychologist that calls imitation the social glue. By imitating each other, we become close to each other, we understand each other, we feel like each other. And there is a strong link between imitation and empathy. We did a series of studies that, first of all, show that the eyes of the human brain that contain these cells are very important for imitation. But then we wanted to ask, so are they also important for empathy? There seems to be a link between imitation and empathy. There's a phenomenon called the chameleon effect. Humans tend to imitate each other when they interact. And there are some studies that really show nicely that there's this automatic tendency to, you're not even aware of it. You just imitate what other people do, or you're not even aware of it. You do it unconsciously and automatically. Well, it turns out there are differences between individuals. Some people are more chameleons than others. Some people tend to imitate others more than other people. And there's a nice correlation. The more you tend to be a chameleon, the more you tend to imitate others when you interact socially with them, the more you tend to empathize with them. And so,
yeah, I found that really fascinating when I read that in your book, because most of the people that I know in Sedona here, you know, it's known as a psychic town, and most of the people that I know that are very empathic are people that do interact very closely with a lot of other people. And, you know, they're the ones that go out to the parties, you know, they're the ones that are always, you know, concerned about how someone else feels and all that kind of stuff. And,
right.
And my question about that is this inherent in everyone, or is this a learned behavior from the parents?
Well, that's a great question. We don't know yet. I mean, my tendency is to be more like a nurture guy than a nature guy. So I tend to believe that, you know, the experience and how your parents and, you know, other experience, especially early on in life. But, I mean, we have evidence that people can change even later on in life, and brains can change even later on in life. I think that experience really shapes these responses. Probably it's a mix of the two. There is probably some level of, you know, natural inclination or genetic endowment or whatever. But most of it, I would say, it's kind of shaped by experience. And now we're doing actually studies that try to look into how the mirror neuron system, these cells, are actually shaped by experience.
Yeah, before I forget, too, I wanted to ask you about the babies. You had one section in there where you're talking about how babies start to imitate right away, and they
right.
become proficient, was it by age 3?
Yeah, I mean, the work of Andy Meltzer that demonstrated that even infants that are not even 1 hour old, the youngest baby that he tested was 41 minutes old. And he was able to show that this baby could imitate some facial expression. So that was really a revolutionary work in the 70s, because at that time the idea was that babies learn to imitate much later on in life, around the second year of life.
Mm-hmm.
And Meltzer really demonstrated that babies imitate right away from the get-go. And by doing that, I mean, they can really learn a lot of things through imitation. But it's not just about learning. It's really about connecting with people. Imitation really seems to be the social glue. You go to a party and you see, when there are, say, grown-ups and also, you know, very young children or babies, you start imitating what the baby does, and you become immediately the most popular grown-up in the room. They are delighted by and they play these imitation games. And, you know, having bodies in synchrony is something that really connects people at a very basic level, preverbal, emotional, something that, you know, it's very difficult to describe in words, but it's very powerful.
Yeah, you also mentioned in the book that that there are some monkeys that don't have that ability, and that other monkeys have just a vestige of it, and then it can be developed. And so I found that fascinating, too. And I'm wondering, you know, how far down the chain is this going? And is this a phenomena that is happening because more people are interacting with animals more, and then they're interacting in kind with other animals? Or is this just something that's just physiological as far as animals go?
Well, if you look at animal behavior, you can clearly see that there is a strong influence of the environment. For instance, all the best things that animals can do, like primates, like chimpanzees, or other kinds of primates, even down to the level of monkeys. If the animals are reared in a human environment, they are really good at doing a lot of cognitive things, like, you know, for instance, the passing what is called the mirror test in which you recognize your face reflected by a mirror, which is something that humans are able to do it toward the end, second year of life. And primates, some primates can do it, but the best ones are really the ones that are freed by in a human environment. So clearly, I would say that in that case, the environment really makes a big difference. I mean, when it comes to individual differences in animals, being reared in a human environment, in a rich environment, in a stimulated environment, it really makes a huge difference. And of course, we can extrapolate that works also in humans. And in fact, we have evidence even for that. I mean, there's famous cases, for instance, of children in very harsh situations that do not develop as well as typically developing kids.
Yeah, that brings up another question. You had another section in there where you were talking about babies that did not have the chance to imitate did not thrive. And,
right.
You know, the studies years ago, you know, as we're coming up through the medical profession, they all say that, you know, babies have to be held and loved, and if they don't, if you just leave them alone, they actually can die. And I'm wondering if a lot of that has to do with atrophy of those motor neurons because they don't get stimulated.
Absolutely. I strongly believe that that's the case. I mean, for instance, when we looked into this system and we thought, okay, what if this system goes, if something goes wrong in this system, what can happen? Of course, the first thing that we thought it could happen is that you have problems with social interactions. If you have problems with social interaction, of course, every social interaction becomes so difficult for you and so stressful that social behavior is something you try to avoid. And so we thought, well, this seems to be really a system that could be really important, one of the core deficits of autism. And so we started looking into that, and we have this hypothesis, the mirror neuron hypothesis of autism. And we have evidence now, we have really nice studies that demonstrate that there is reduced activity in mirror neuron areas in kids with autism. And there is even a correlation such that the more reduced is the activity, the more severe is the disorder. Now, the whole thing, this is of course a hypothesis, but the whole thing we think comes really early on in life. And one of the problems that these kids have is that they do not look at people. So in my lecture, I always give this kind of a situation or scenario to explain what's going on early on in life and what can go wrong. So you have an interaction between, say, the baby and the caregiver. The baby smiles. It's natural for the caregiver, the mother, the father, or the caregiver in the daycare center to smile back at the baby. Now, in the baby's brain, it's very simple to associate the motor plan for smiling with the sight of somebody else smiling. And now you have a mirror neuron for smiling. So the interaction between the baby and the caregiver creates these mirror cells.
Mm.
What can go wrong in kids with autism is that it's been demonstrated that they tend not to look at people when they, even very early on in life, even in the first year of life, compared to typically developing children. Suppose, again, you have an interaction between the baby and the caregiver, and the baby smiles, and the caregiver smiles back. If this baby is not looking at the caregiver, as typically developing kids do, there's no way that in the baby brain you can create an association between the motor plan for smiling and the sight of somebody else smiling. And so mirror neurons cannot be formed. So the hypothesis is that, in fact, I mean, what can happen is that because they have this tendency not to look at people and so not to engage in these imitation games that go on between the baby and the adult, the caregiver, then you have a deficit in this system in patients with autism. The good news is that you can retrain these cells. There's now interventions based on imitation that seem to be very effective on these kids. The data are very preliminary, but there are some studies that seem to suggest that, in fact, these interventions that are based on imitation seem to help these kids a lot.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And, you know, as I was looking at that, I was wondering, okay, what would cause them in the first place not to have that natural tendency to look at other people?
That's
and is it question. Is it just that the brain is not developed enough or... You know, what went wrong that they
well,
wouldn't
I
do?
Right. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was done. Just, you know, I'm just wondering what went wrong in their brains that would cause that in the first place that they wouldn't look.
Right. Well, I think that what can, I mean, there are two possibilities here, is that maybe there is already a primary deficit in this system, in the mirror neuron system, such that they are not really able to encode the actions of, I mean, we believe that even though, I believe that even though experience really shapes this system a lot, it's not just experience. There must be something at birth, because, you know, the work of Meltzer that suggests that, demonstrates that very young infants can imitate at least some very simple facial expression. It really tells us that at least some mirror neurons are over there in our brains at birth. So there may be a little deficit in those mirror neurons in our brains at birth. And if you don't have those, it's very difficult for you to decode the actions of other people. And so, of course, you don't find other people very interesting. And that could be an explanation for why they don't look at people. Another possibility is that there is some other factor that we don't understand that drives these kids not to look at other people but look at objects. That's the alternative possibility.
Yeah, that brings up a whole spate of other questions too, and that's fascinating. You know, as you're talking about that, about looking at objects rather than people, I was thinking about the mental disorder where the people are sexually attracted to objects, and I'm wondering if that has a correlation to the mirror neurons.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. I mean, I never actually made the link, but in fact, there is a possibility, in fact, there is something like that going on. Let me tell you actually about this. I actually mentioned these type of cells in the book, but I don't discuss them at length. These are called canonical neurons. And they are cells that are located, in the monkey brain at least, are located in the same areas in which mirror neurons are located, neighboring area in which mirror neurons are located. And what these cells do are, from the motor standpoint, it's identical to mirror neurons. They fire when, you know, say the monkey grasps something or when the monkey holds something and so on. So they fire for actions of the monkey. The difference of canonical cells compared to mirror cells is that while the mirror cells fire when the monkey is just completely still watching somebody else making the action, canonical neurons do not fire for when the monkey is observing somebody else making an action. But they do fire if you put a graspable object in front of the monkey. So suppose you have a canonical cell that fires when the monkey, say, grasps a large object, like an orange with a whole end. If you put the orange in front of the monkey, even if the monkey is not grasping it, that cell will also fire. The firing of these cells almost suggested coding some kind of the affordance of the object. I can grab that thing. And there is some evidence that canonical neurons and mirror neurons kind of inhibit each other. And so it's possible, in fact, you know, in this particular individual, there is a hyperactivity of these canonical cells that kind of suppress the activity of mirror cells, and that creates this interest toward objects.
Fascinating. Yeah, boy, I've got so many questions. I could keep you on for a couple hours. Yeah, this is really, I've been very interested in the workings of the human mind now for quite some time, and have had to deal with a lot of strange people, when I worked in the ER and stuff. And you always wonder what went wrong in their brain that would cause them to think the things that they do and to behave the way that they do. And, this explains so much. For instance, when you start talking about the link between this imitation and the media violence and how it was shown that kids would be more violent and even adults tended to be more aggressive just from watching these things. And, of course, that opened my mind up to the whole thing of, well, what about pornography? You know, look
right.
at how pervasive that's become in our society and the problems that it's caused. And maybe it's all due to these mirror neurons, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that's the, you know, the the side effect of, or the dark side of the moon of mirror neurons. I think mirror neurons are great cells because I think that they tell us something important about us. I want to start first with the positive, and then I'm going to respond to answer your question about the And I think the positive thing, is, and that's the way actually I kind of conclude the book with a really nice note of optimism. We have this, we've been told for years that the traditional view is that our biology is bad, it's all about self-preservation, individualism. We become good because of our beliefs, of our higher order ideas. I mean, the story about mirror cells, it tells us that in fact evolution has really shaped us to be wired for empathy. We have a potential in our brain to be empathic, to be connected with others in a very powerful way. And so that's the great news about mirror neurons. And really, I think that this is going to really change the way we have to think about us and also about, you know, a lot of other things, like, you know, the classic idea is that religion is about thinking, well, you know, you tend to be bad because your biology, your nature, your natural inclination is bad, but with your religious belief, you become good and moral. It seems that actually our evolution, the evolutionary process made us empathic and even moral in some way. So it really changes the, a lot of things. But now let's go, you know, to the side effects. The side effects is that, in fact, we have this tendency to just do what we see, to imitate what we see. And because mirror cells do that, they explain a lot of data on media violence and imitative violence. Turns out that there's plenty of behavioral studies that show that there is a strong link between being exposed to media violence and then displaying violent behavior, what is called imitative violence. And all this data have been often dismissed. And I think there are two main factors that are at play here. One is, you know, financial interest. Violence sells well, especially in the media. And so there's clearly a lot of interest in kind of suppressing this notion that if you get exposed to violence, you can become violent. The other one is that it's really unsettling. I mean, because it basically tells us, well, you know, our cherished notion of free will, maybe we have to revise it. Maybe we are actually so influenced by what we see that we actually start doing what we see. And so our free will, our notion of free will should be revised. That's kind of unsettling. We kind of do not accept that too well. But there's plenty of data that show that, you know, if you're exposed to violence, you become violent. And in fact, now with mirror neurons, we have a very compelling neurophysiological mechanism that explains how it is, why we do that.
Yeah, that boy, holy moly! There are so many things there that I'm thinking about. You know, I was thinking about all of the science fiction fans, and I'm one of those too. You know, and and I remember when I was younger, I used to think, what is wrong with me that I love to watch science fiction, and I watch all these really strange things. And then as I got older and realized that I was very empathic and psychic and all these things and had to deal with people that had these things happening in their lives for real, then I thought, well, you know, that actually trained me to kind of take care of these people, you know, and to not be shocked and to be able to see things. And, you know, with all the changes that are happening right now, my question is always, when we see something strange, are we actually seeing it? Is it really there? And we're just now seeing it because the veils are thinner or whatever they want to call it. Or are we actually moving into mental aberration like the psychiatrists have been trying to tell us for years? Mm-hmm. You know, what's the real truth about that? And why do we have these things that are passed on like myths and things, and then they're made into movies and they still remain as part of the human consciousness? And, you know, why? And with the mirror neurons the way they are, oh my gosh, we all know how to take care of vampires now, right?
Exactly. You know, one of they really explain a lot of, you know, it's been called meme, you know, to kind of borrow the notion of gene in genetics. The idea is that you can transmit behaviors between people, almost like, you know, you transmit viruses or you pass from one generation to another given behavior. I think that, you know, there are anthropologists that have studied imitation as really as a powerful glue that it's important for cultural transmission. And all these kinds of things, really, to me, they really have to do with, you know, with our mirror neurons work. And they really, remember, these cells are really cells that code the actions of ourselves and of other people. So the, and they really make us close to each other. They create what I, one of my slogans, that they create the intimacy between self and others, especially in the Western culture, this idea that the self is so detached from other people. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we feel a lot of connectedness with others, and mirror neurons really help us doing that. I think they create these bonds and this ability to connect with others and to feel what other people feel, and also to be influenced by what you see and what other people are doing. You know, your own experience in terms of visual experience, what you know, your surroundings and so on. And so what you were saying, one of the critics of mirror neurons say, well, you know, they seem to be able to explain everything. Well, it turns out that they explain a lot of things because they're really the cornerstone of social interactions, and humans interact socially all the time, and we are shaped. Our life is really shaped by our interactions.
Well, yeah, and the whole question of compassion, and the section you had in there about the experiments of the people seeing someone in pain and their own pain levels going up, that was fascinating.
Yeah, in fact, there is clearly evidence that this is the case, that you have this automatic tendency to do that. We see somebody in pain and we have an immediate, we feel, of course, in a reduced form, we don't feel really the pain of the person in pain, but we feel it right away. It's automatic. We don't have really to make any, you know, complex inference about, oh, well, that guy is in pain, and so because that guy is in pain and I'm watching him in pain, then I should feel in pain too. It's something that it just comes out automatically. And, you know, thinkers that have, in my book, I start the fourth chapter, which is about empathy and feeling what other people feel, with a beautiful quote from Adam Smith. He wrote a beautiful description of this whole phenomenon three centuries ago. He didn't have brain imaging. He wasn't studying the monkey brain, but he had a really good, he was a good observer, and he had also good introspection, and he has a beautiful description of this whole phenomenon. You see somebody in pain, and you have an immediate, you feel pain in yourself when you see somebody else. And we have this drive to feel what others feel, and I think that's to me, it's really the basis of empathy and even the basis of morality. I think that's why we tend to be good. I mean, we emphasize a lot what the bad things we do, but after all, we do a lot of good things, and again, we take them for granted. And that's something that I call it, you know, the basis of secular morality, because, you know, if it really comes from all the way back to the monkeys, it's really something that's been shaped by evolution. And I think that's an important message.
Yeah, I think that is the takeaway message, really, of the whole book. I thought the way that you wrote it was so beautiful. And not only giving all the scientific background and how this all came about, which was pretty exciting in the first place, but I love the way that you ended it with talking about, you know, how that does shape society, how it shapes humanity as a species, and teaches us to be more kind and gentle with the other species upon the planet. And that's an important thing for people to understand, that, you know, it's not a fluke. It's the reality of who we are. And it's all planned, basically. You know, whoever put those mirror neurons in our head knew what they were doing.
Exactly. And I think that the other thing is that an important message that this story, that this neuroscience discovery tell us is that neuroscience, scientists tend to be kind of isolated compared to the rest of the society, tend to kind of do their own work and to talk with our colleagues, and tend to speak in kind of a jargon that is difficult to understand, tend to stay away from, like, political issues or societal issues at large. But I think that it's about time that scientists and science in general become more a more powerful factor in our societal decisions. And, you know, the story about mirror neurons, what it tells us about us is, you know, the human condition and our inclinations and so on. It's really important. It's very important to tell people about it, because I think that people have been good all along, But they were not aware of that because they didn't know about these cells. And now that we can even talk about this stuff, I think people can become more aware of their own potential to be good and to be empathic. And they can reflect on these things. And in fact, I mean, one thing that an experience I have in my when I give my lectures, now that this story has become so popular, I don't just lecture to my colleagues, but also to lay people and to non-specialists. They have this, when I tell them about these cells and how they work and how they can explain human behavior, I see a lot of people nodding. They see themselves in these things. They have an immediate recognition of what's their own experience. It's very meaningful to them.
Yeah, it explains so much. And, I mean, how many times have people done something and said, damn, why did I do that? And, you know, and they've said to themselves, I know better. Why would I do that? And it's usually when they're in a group with other people and you know, well, like the whole mob mentality. You know,
and
like you said, it is like a virus. It's very contagious. And all of a sudden, you know, one person gets it, then another, and all of a sudden you have a mob running after somebody rioting and things. And likewise, you know, you can have a mob of people that is caught by the spirit and just has this incredible enlightenment moment all as a group. So it's quite amazing. And also, if you would tell people a little bit about the functional MRI and how you're using it to discover these great, wonderful things about what's happening in the brain, because I don't think most people have really heard of the functional MRI.
That's a good thing to do. So functional MRI, it's basically like an MRI machine, the same machine that you use to look into your brain and to see, you know, the anatomy of the brain, if there is something that goes wrong in the brain and so on. But although the machine is identical, if you change the software, what you can do is to look into how the brain responds and activates while subjects or patients are doing various things. So you can ask patients to make some actions or to watch some things or to remember things. And, of course, every time you do all these things, different parts of the brain activate. And functional MRI is able to track down all these changes in the brain because what it tracks down is the oxygenation of the blood. And the oxygenation of the blood really goes together with the activity in the brain. So if a brain area in my brain lights up, my neurons fire, the oxygenation in that brain area changes, and so a functional MRI can actually track that down and can make images out of that. So we are able to look into how the brain activates its various brain regions without injecting any radioactive material, any contrast agent, just by using physiological changes in the brain of our subject. So it's extremely safe. And it's very nice because it gives us, you know, you can look at the whole brain and you can see how the brain responds to a variety of different things.
Yeah, that's a much kinder, gentler way to do it.
That's right.
Yeah, I was thinking about that with relation to, you know, there's been a lot of things in the news lately about how they can now tell with a brain scan if someone is going to commit a crime. And, you know, that shades of that movie that Tom Cruise did, you know.
Right.
But, I mean, they're really talking about now that, in fact, I think there was something in the news about someone who was actually convicted, and there was no physical proof at all, but they did a MRI scan, functional MRI, and decided that she had killed her husband or something.
Well, I haven't heard about this case. I would be worried if the only evidence would be fMRI because you're still in a situation in which you can't, you know, you get to interpret the data. When it comes to our research, for instance, on mirror neurons, what we did was to look at how the individual cells in the monkey brain responded in a variety of situations, and then we modeled those responses such that we were predicting the same responses with the MRI signal in the brain, and we found some regions that had exactly that profile of responses in a variety of situations. But we had the luxury of having the monkey data. When it comes to using imaging brain imaging techniques like fMRI to say, well, you're lying or you're not lying or you have committed a crime or not, and there's no other evidence, I would be very nervous because there may be, there's certainly a margin of error in that case, and you don't want to send somebody in jail just by using that technique, let me tell you that.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought. I was shocked when I saw that. I couldn't believe it. Because, you know, there's always a margin of error in pretty much anything that you do. So, you know, to convict somebody of something like that was just ludicrous.
Right.
But, you know, strange things are afoot in the world. Mm-hmm. And, also, in your book you were talking about people that had brain damage. And I think, now correct me if I'm wrong, but originally it was discovered that these mirror neurons were in the adjacent to Broca's area, right? In the right
side
of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was found that, or it was hypothesized that people would not be able to do the mirroring tasks if that part of the brain was damaged, and
right.
yet they could. So there was some area on the left, and I can't remember now where that was.
Well, first of all, one thing we're doing an experiment in which we look into patients with epilepsy, and for medical reasons, so it's not really a scientific reason, it's just a medical one, they get implanted electrodes, and the reason why they get electrodes implanted in the brain, which is a very invasive technique, it's because the surgeon wants to know exactly where is the focus of epilepsy, and he wants to remove only the part of the brain that is diseased in some way, and he doesn't want to remove parts of the brain that do not have epilepsy. You know, so in order to do that, they need to implant electrodes in the brain of these patients. It turns out that in those few days in which they had the electrodes implanted, we can do some experiments on these patients if they allow us to do that. And we are discovering that, in fact, mirror cells are located in many different brain regions. So having a lesion in an area that contains a lot of mirror cells can probably not be so fatal because you can actually use other brain areas that also contain mirror neurons to kind of do the same function. But you mentioned Broca's areas and mirror neurons. I think that's something that we left out of our conversation, and it's really a fascinating aspect of this research. Because it turns out that in Broca's area there's plenty of mirror neurons, there's a hypothesis that says that these cells in the monkey brain were kind of the precursors of the system in the human brain for language. Broca's area is an area of the brain that is important for language. And why would be that? I mean, the idea is that, again, what they do is these cells is they fire when you make an action, when you see somebody else making an action. So they create an immediate understanding of the actions of other people. It turns out that when we talk, we don't just talk. I mean, what I'm doing now, you don't see me doing that, but I'm doing it, and I'm pretty sure you're doing the same thing. And there are studies that really show that. Everybody uses their hands. We gesture a lot. It's part of our way of communicating. Even when we know that the people that we are talking to cannot even see our own hands. So the hand is part of language, and of course Italians do that even more than other people.
And I am part Italian, you know. So.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, well, then I guess you're also gesturing a lot.
Yes, I am.
We communicate, and of course mirror neurons seem to be very important for that because they fire up when we make the gesture, and they also fire up when we see somebody else making it. So again, they create an easy communication between two people.
Yeah, that makes it much easier. I know there's a lot of times when if you can't talk, for instance, you can use your gestures to pantomime.
Right.
And people will get it. And, you know, there's several universal things, you know, like drinking or eating or seeing or, you know, certain things that that everybody in every culture does.
Which I find
fascinating, too. I wonder if that's like when you get a new PC and you have software already loaded on it. Do we already have that loaded in our brains?
Yeah. Turns out that even, when you can't find a word, there are studies that show that people, it's called the tip of the tongue phenomenon. When you want to say a word, it just doesn't come out.
Mm-hmm.
Just before you are finally able to retrieve that word, before that, you actually make a hand gesture. And so the hypothesis is that the hand gesture itself helps retrieving the word that you couldn't find.
Ooh, that's interesting. Very interesting. And I wonder, do you know if... people who are recovering from stroke and have different types of aphasia, do they do that more so than other people?
Yeah, there are some studies on that. It's not very clear, but my hypothesis would be that, in fact, if you have Broca's aphasia in some way, it's going to really help you a lot if you even use some form of motor rehabilitation, even just using the hand and so on. But certainly there are now data that show that, the classical rehabilitation, when you have a motor deficit after a stroke, what you do, you do your physical therapy. And, of course, nobody's going to replace that. That's very important. But it turns out if you, on top of that, you give the patient a videotape, so that at home the patient can just sit down in the living room and watch the videotape the tape shows a variety of actions that the patient has done during the physical therapy. That helps a lot. And the idea is that, again, mirror neurons are involved in this. I mean, again, but just by watching other people doing an action, you activate the same cells that in your brain can help you making the action. And so a patient that has brain damage and a motor deficit, just by watching other people making an action, can recover faster.
That's really useful. Yeah, because, for years people have been saying, the visualization is important. And I wonder what role that plays if, for instance, you're meditating on being able to do the actions. And I know they've done studies and shown that sports figures do much better when they meditate and they see themselves hitting the ball and, follow it through.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering if that works just as well for stroke victims or if they have to see someone else actually doing it because of the stroke damage.
Well, I think that both things help in a way. The way I describe these things, that they're all representations of action. When you make an action, when you observe somebody else making an action, and even when you think about making an action, these are all different forms of representing an action. But I would say that in the case of patients with stroke, probably watching helps more than mentally rehearsing, because for them it's so difficult to mentally rehearse given that they are not able to do the action themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That if you have an external input that helps you visualizing the action, is probably better. But for athletes, I mean, it's well known that if you kind of do mental rehearsal of the things that the actions that you perform during the game, you're going to do very well. And it turns out that brain imaging studies show that the same areas of the brain that control, that activate when you make an action, so the motor cortex, also activates when you're actually just thinking about making the action.
Yeah, we have busy little brains, don't we?
Yeah, that's right.
This has been just amazing, and boy, we're at the end of the hour already. Wow.
Oh, well.
I am so happy to know about your research and to know about the things that have been discovered. And I think that you write in a way that even lay people can understand, which is very important if you want to sell a lot of books,
Well, I think that the reason behind writing the book is that it's been kind of difficult because, again, we tend to write in a much more jargon-laden kind of way. But I really wanted to reach out because the idea is that I think that, again, the way the book ends is to give a message of hope that, science can be important in our society and can really shape societal decisions. And it's important that people understand how science is progressing and also understand the main message of this kind of science. And so in order to do that, you get to write in a way that is accessible to non-specialists. And I'm happy every time somebody that is not a neuroscientist or a scientist in general tells me, well, I read your book and it's great, it's been engaging, I understood everything, it's fascinating, and I'm really excited about this research, because that was exactly my goal, to reach out to a large number of people so they can be more aware of the research we're doing.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. Thank you for writing that book. And thank you for being on the show. And we have been talking with Dr. Marco Iacoboni about things that are in his new book, Mirroring People, the New Science of How We Connect with Others. And I recommend it. I have read it cover to cover and enjoyed the heck out of it. And I put markers in it all over the place because there were so many things that were important in there. So I'm very happy about that book, and so happy that you came on the show. Thank you so much for sharing all these wonderful things, Dr. Iacoboni.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you are so welcome. And I'm looking forward to your next book.
Oh, well, it'll take a little while.
You're going to do some more experiments, huh?
Exactly.
Well, I'm sure they're going to be equally as fascinating. So thank you so much for being on the show. And before we sign off for the night, I'd like to let everybody know that the show is supported by Hydramay Skin Nutrition. And if you go to my webpage here on BBS, you'll see an ad for Hydramay. And I highly recommend it. It is nutrients for your skin, non-greasy, leaves your skin feeling soft. It's all natural. And you know me, I'm the natural girl, so I love to have things like that that are healthy for you, and you don't have to worry about bad things being absorbed into your bloodstream. And it just, it leaves your skin really nice. And Marjorie that created this is a wonderful woman who just loves to present products that are really, really useful. So if you haven't tried that, I do suggest you do try it, and they are the show sponsor. So thank you to Hydramay Skin Nutrition. And thank you, Dr. Marco Iacoboni, for being on. And why don't you go ahead and give your contact information so people can drop you a line or check out some more of your studies along the way.
Sure. I mean, the easiest way to reach me is through email. And so the email is Iacoboni, which is spelled I-A-C-O, B as in Bob, O, N as in Nancy, I, at UCLA. edu.
Great, thank you. And also the information is up on the show info, so if anybody has forgotten that or you don't have a pen or pencil with you, you can go to the show info thing on my Tuesday night show description and scroll down and you will find a picture of Dr. Iacoboni there and the contact information and all that. So, boy, that show went fast. As usual, thank you everybody for listening, and I hope that this helped everyone to understand themselves and other people a little bit better. And as always, until next week, be happy, be healthy, and be who you really are. Nighty night.
Rise to a new day with each your soul the key.